if we look over the history of the caliphate, and I guess it's a broad sweep, so this is rather a general question, but in what sense does it help to understand the caliphate as primarily a political institution on one hand and as a religious institution on the other? Is it both those things? Does the distinction not really apply?
I think it's probably not that helpful to divide up things into political and religious, partly because the notion of religious that we have depends on extrapolating from an Enlightenment reading of Western Christian history at a particular period in time, and then trying to fit everything into that little hole of what is religious and what is not. So it just makes things more difficult rather than less difficult. I think the best way to understand the caliphate is firstly as an institution of governance over large Muslim areas, and the fact that it has changed in its significance in over time is because it's something like almost 1400 years old of continuously being a continuous institution. So obviously institution for that long lasting is bound to go through different changes and different kinds of relationships, etc. So it's difficult to pick out what it was all the time in any particular general sense. What you can do, though, is see it much more symbolically, what it's come to mean nowadays. And I think the three things that I would point to, one is the continuity, that the caliphate pointed to a continuity of the Muslim presence onwards. Secondly, it pointed to a kind of sense of unity. Again, the reality may have been different, but it did suggest that there was something in common. And thirdly, and most importantly, it pointed to having a say, to being a great power in the world. So those are the three things which are kind of symbolically what people understand by the caliphate, apart from the kind of legalistic, more detailed kind of traditions. But it's really the metaphor which I think is important.
And that time when the Islamic world was in a position of great power and prestige, it was also a territorial entity, right? We talk about, you know, the Islamic Empire. And I wonder how important is it to understand or to distinguish between the caliphate and this idea of an Islamic state, you know, with territorial borders and the other trappings of nationhood.
Sure. I think what's happened is this, that all of these kinds of conversations take place after 1924, when effectively the Turkish leadership, the Kemalist, abolished the caliphate. Up to that point, there was discussions about what qualities you needed to have a good caliph, but there were not really discussions about how should Muslim societies be organized, do they need a government, do they need a state, etc. Because the idea was you already have a legitimate institution, so it was really to try to reform it. When the caliphate becomes abolished, you then suddenly have the opening of the questions about what significance it really has. Can you be a Muslim without living under a Muslim government? And all of these things became possible, and different intellectuals, different groups took different kinds of positions. Out of that ferment, the idea of an Islamic state was born, but these Islamic states were really not conceived as being all-encompassing, but really as smaller entities, really the nation states and the colonial states being Islamicized rather than something which was going to be new and transnational and transgressive. So in a sense, the caliphate was really became replaced by the idea of the Islamic state. And now what we have with ISIS is really an attempt to revoke the caliphate as a way of unifying or attempting to unify and get rid of these boundaries which have divided up the Muslim lands.
I'll come to ISIS in a minute, but first I want to ask you about, you talk about the abolition of the caliphate, of course, which happened in 1924. And one thing that I was really struck by looking over the history of the 20th century is I don't really find much evidence of a kind of a pan-Islamic outrage at the abolition of the caliphate in 1924. Calls for the restoration of the caliphate throughout the 20th century don't seem to be very strong. Is that how you see it, or is my understanding of history a little deficient there?
I don't see it like that. I think you have to put these... For example, in Malaysia, which was never under the Ottoman rule, There were protest demonstrations throughout the Muslim lands, even in areas where the Ottomans never had any direct control, or there was a sense that something had been lost. And there was a sense of outrage. The problem with outrage is that you have to have mechanisms and infrastructures to be able to express it, articulate it, further it. And you have to remember that at that time, 80% of the Muslim populations were living under European colonial rule. So their means of actually expressing themselves on any particular issue were severely restricted. But you have a very interesting thing. Just before the caliphate is abolished in 24, you have, for example, in 1916 in Australia, a group of eight Muslims holding up a train in from Adelaide to Darwin, I think.
Yeah, the Battle of Broken Hill, as it's called.
And raising the caliphate flag. Now, they were Afghanis, of Afghani descent anyway. The caliphate has never been in Australia. So why were they doing that? So obviously, what I'm trying to say to you, the idea of the caliphate actually circulated much beyond its kind of the territorial extent of the Ottoman state. It circulated despite the fact that it was very difficult for Muslims living under colonial rule to express some of these ideas because of heavy restrictions and things. For in India, for example, you had the major movement, the Caliphate movement, which tried to argue for the restoration. You have conferences being held, you know, straight afterwards among Arabian leaders, Arabian Peninsula leaders, and others in Cairo and things, to trying to say, well, we should try and restore the caliphate. And of course, what happens at these conferences, a lot of people want to be the caliph rather than wanting to restore the caliphate. So I would argue that, in fact, if you look at that kind of history, which has kind of been dismissed or marginalized, there is actually quite an interesting ferment going on, that this issue has more legs than it's normally pointed to.
Well, let's look at if we go back to July this year, the spectacle of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi standing up in the Grand Mosque in Mosul, proclaiming himself as caliph and the institution of a new caliphate. What has been? I mean, what was your response to that at the time, and what has been your? How have you thought about it since?
I think the declaration of the caliphate has to be understood in two ways. Firstly, it is a part of a power struggle between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Al-Qaeda have always argued that they want the restoration of the caliphate, but we're not there yet. So, for example, when they were entrenched in Afghanistan, they would call it the Emirate of Afghanistan. So the idea was there were emirates, and eventually the emirates would form a caliphate once you had a large enough of number of these emirates. Now, what Baghdadi and ISIS have done, have trumped that, said, look, you know what, we have already jumped that stage. Yeah. So that's one part of it, because they're making a claim now to be actually superior to Al-Qaeda. The second part is this, that ISIS have taken over territories which are really transnational. They're on the borderlands of Syria and Iraq. Now, that's not even a region as such. So they're in a kind of conundrum what to actually call, how to designate what they rule. There's no kind of, they can't say, well, this is a region that we've ruled before and it has some sort of integrity of its own. And the fact that they're eroding these national boundaries between Syria and Iraq, it allows them to actually make the claim that this is a transnational entity. So I think that's the other element why they've called themselves a caliphate. The problem with them is that their idea of the caliphate is so kind of restrictive and so kind of xenophobic that it is not viable. And their lack of legitimacy is manifested in almost, the kind of degree of their violence undermines any claims of legitimacy, which then again undermines what most Muslims would expect from a legitimate form of Islamic governance.
Indeed, and we see and hear Islamic leaders denouncing ISIS left, right, and centre, and openly, you know, saying that their claim to have restored the caliphate is Islamically invalid. And yet, I wonder if what they have done is important, in that it sort of let the genie out of the bottle, and now the idea of the caliphate is really sort of firing the imaginations of Muslims in a way that hadn't perhaps been the case for the last few decades. Is that how you see it?
Well, you have to remember that the caliphate has had this kind of ghostly existence before ISIS you know, sort of really declared itself to be the caliphate. In 2007, the Home Secretary, Charles Clark, made a speech in Washington where he gave four areas in which Western governments could not accommodate Islamist demands. And one of them was they could not allow the Islamist to have a caliphate. Subsequently, around about the same time, the Pentagon's commissions a kind of study, one of these future things, what will the world will be like in 20 years' time. And in that study, one of the scenarios they have is the restoration of the caliphate in some part of the Middle East. So the idea of the caliphate has actually been circulating around two main sources, two main circles. One has been Western statecraft, which has been talking about it for a while and hinting at it, you know, saying this is something that we cannot have, both at the level of actual policy practitioners, but also policy opinion makers, etc. A lot of, for example, neocon commentary has been really, we have to stop Al-Qaeda because they want a caliphate. We have to stop a caliphate because it's going to be Islamic imperialism, etc. And that's been a steady start. And this has happened even before ISIS declared the caliphate. So that's one. And the other way is that, like I said, since 1924, the idea of the caliphate has been, in various permutations and various guises, has been circulating among Islamicate intellectual circles. Sometimes they've called it directly the caliphate. Other times they've talked about Islamic State. They've talked about Muslim unity. They've talked about all of these things which point to the absence of the caliphate, put it that way. So I think the caliphate's already been there for 90 years, but no one's actually been willing to name it. And I think what ISIS have done is have named it, but it's already been around.
And so how much enthusiasm do you discern then among, to use, you know, for want of a better term, ordinary British Muslims in the UK for this idea of the caliphate being restored?
I think there's two things. If you look at various poll results and things like that, in general, Muslims don't have a sense of antipathy to the idea of the caliphate, which is different than whether they accept that the ISIS version of the caliphate is what they mean by the caliphate, if that makes sense. So I think there is a sense in which the caliphate is okay in principle, but they do not think, by and large, that ISIS really demonstrate any of the qualities that they would want to have from a caliphate.
And yet we have this, you know, this familiar spectre, which is often raised by Western governments, of the disaffected young Muslim male living in the West, culturally isolated, you know, wandering around full of resentment, plotting who knows what. It's a prominent image, a very sort of powerful image. And I wonder if you feel that immigration and the movement of Muslims to the West has resulted in a situation where, you know, while a Muslim in Jordan or Saudi Arabia or any other Muslim country might feel that he or she is at home, for a Muslim in Europe or America or Australia, the appeal of global Islam is likely to be a lot stronger.
I think it's a bit more, it's the other way around to some extent. I think up till about 9/11, there was a distinct sense in which Muslims felt that in many Western countries, they were much more able to have conversations about Islam. Mosques weren't under security surveillance. Governments rarely intervened in what Muslims were doing. And therefore, you know, Muslim ideas and conversations and intellectual exchanges could flourish. And a lot of these groups did. And often they would say, well, this goes to show that, you know, Western countries are democratic and they allow us to have these debates, whereas in Muslim countries, even as a Muslim, I can't talk about Islam. Now, since 9/11, what's happened is this, that position has actually changed so that it's not that different in terms of whether you can talk about Islam openly. You have, for example, in many cases where various members of law enforcement agencies, both clandestine and open, are surveying Muslims, there's a constant kind of sense of being watched, the whole securitization of these issues. So as a consequence, the experience of Muslims is actually flattening out. There's no such big differences anymore in relation to the role of governance and regulation over them. I think the broader point, though, I think is not just immigration. I think it's globalization itself. I think one of the key things, and I think this is true, is that when Muslims come to Australia, they come from many different countries, but when they encounter each other, they actually are much more able to see the universality of Islam. So, for example, a Muslim from Afghanistan in Australia is more likely to meet a Muslim from Indonesia than in Australia than they would in Afghanistan. So as a sense, what you have is a kind of a reinforcement of the cosmopolitan nature of Islam. And that process, I think, has certainly taken off in many of the large Western urban centers. But I think it's also because of, you know, internet, satellite communications, the case that Muslims throughout the world are far more aware of Muslims in other parts of the world than they used to be. And as a consequence, there is an articulation of an Islam which is far more abstracted from the local and which far emphasizes much more universal generalistic principles.
That's interesting. I take your point, and yet often the call for the caliphate is interpreted by some Western commentators as a symbol of just a sort of a reactionary rejection of globalization, of modernity, of westernization, rather than a proper, you know, a thought out political alternative in its own right. You're saying it's more nuanced than that?
I think it's absolutely much more nuanced than that. And I think, I mean, look, you know as well as I do, it's not a secret, there are many Western commentators who, if they believed in global warming, would find a way to blame Muslims for it. And I think there is a sort of Islamophobic trend which sees any assertion of Muslim rights or Muslim autonomy as a threat to the world as we know it. And I don't think that's particularly helpful or particularly useful. You know, the sort of attempts to ban hijabs, burqas, etc. on grounds that armed robberies are committed, etc. I mean, it's a ludicrous kind of thing. So, you know, a lot of armed robbers used to wear stockings on their faces. I have never seen a call being made to ban stockings, for example. So I think anything can be used as a way of trying to say we don't want Muslims to be able to express themselves, rather than trying to say, well, look, there's a way of having that conversation. We don't have to agree with them, but it's going to be difficult for us not to have that conversation. So I think there's an element of that around the issue of the caliphate, because the ultimately, I think what the caliphate represents for most ordinary Muslims is not the minutiae of the historical record, not the minutiae of the legal scholars who think these are the qualities, but really a symbol in which Muslims matter in the world, which Muslims have a mechanism to make appeals, to direct their demands, to direct their concerns at some institutional framework with some idea that this would be effective. And that, it seems to me, is a really crucial point, because in the absence of that kind of political mechanism, you open the road to perpetual violence. And that's where we are. In a sense, the level of insurgencies, terrorism, whatever you want to call it, is directly related to the absence of institutional mechanisms which can allow some of these demands and concerns to be at least represented and perhaps addressed. You know, people talk about ISIS as coming out of this kind of ideology of hatred, etc. ISIS comes completely from el-Sisi. When the Muslim Brotherhood was overthrown after 1 year in government, during Morsi's rule, I think the estimates are maybe four people in Egypt died, which is, again, four too many. Since he's been removal, we have deaths by the state in thousands. And there's a belief, which doesn't seem to be too far-fetched, that certainly the Western powers acquiesced, if not more, in al-Sisi's coup against Morsi. Once you block a political route, then you open up a route of violence. And that's exactly where we are, because the people will turn around. You say you can have peaceful change. You cannot have peaceful change. One of the biggest illusions and one of the biggest problems around this issue is that Western governments and Western societies believe that because they're democratic, they support democracy throughout the world. The experience of those outside the West is very different than that. They have seen repeatedly that Western governments are actually quite capable of having democracy at home and supporting tyranny abroad. Not just once, but nearly always. And that, I think, is the biggest problem here. This leads to a lot of misconceptions, it leads to a lot of anger, but more importantly, it actually increases rather than diffuses the levels of violence and instability in the region.
Well, let's talk about democracy. I'm going to read you some statistics, if you'll forgive me.
Sure.
Research in 2007 across Egypt, Morocco, Indonesia and Pakistan showed that 71% of people favoured the application of Sharia law across the Islamic world, 65% in favour of restoring the caliphate, 74% against Western values in Muslim countries, but then also 67% in favour of democracy. Now, these figures seem surprising to me. It seems to me there's a sort of a confusion there of what caliphate and Sharia and democracy all mean.
But is that your confusion, David, or is the respondent's confusion?
No doubt.
The reason why I say this is because what's really upsetting a lot of people is how can people who want Sharia, caliphate, say no to Western values and still want democracy? Because the assumption is that democracy is a Western value. And it seems to me that is a really pernicious and problematic assumption. It's problematic both kind of on a theoretical, philosophical level, as a lot of recent work has shown, but it's problematic also practically. If you think democracy is simply the same as being Western, then clearly there can be no democracy outside imitation of the West. By and large, the experience of the Muslim world has been wherever there has been an attempt to bring about westernization, it has been done through dictatorships. Now, it seems to me, in a practical way, Hamas, for example, won the elections fair and square in the Palestinian territories. What was the reaction of the United States, Israel, and the EU? We will not accept the result of Hamas winning the election. No one said that the election was flawed or there was rigging, etc. Said the Palestinian people cannot choose their representatives. Now, it seems to me if that is the case, that democracy simply means voting for outcomes that Western powers feel comfortable with, then you are on a collision course between the expression of popular sentiment and what Western powers are comfortable with. So for me, what those survey data completely validates what I've been trying to say. For Muslims, the Sharia, the caliphate, are not anti-democratic.
It's an important point. And yet, if we look at a group like Hizb ut-Tahrir, the Australian spokesperson of which we'll be hearing on this program, his contention is that Islam and democracy are fundamentally opposed, or at least the understanding of democracy that comes with secular modernity. I'll just put that to you.
No, I think what we need to do is I think it's an important point. Let's actually see what we understand by democracy. Now, someone like, for example, Madhudi, who's one of the kind of main ideologues of Islamist groupings, and also Khomeini, another major ideologue, you could argue that these people would never say that Islam is secondary to anything. However, both were willing to accept that you could have competitive and open elections as a way of choosing leadership, that you should have, theoretically, the notion that the people should be able to decide the fate of governance. Now, what I think the Hizb ut-Tahrir and others like them often confuse is that they accept the Western imprint on democracy. And they do this not because they're mistaken necessarily, it's because how democracy is normally talked about. Take, for example, if I asked you what is the root of democracy, you would say to me, well, demos, it comes from the Greek word demos, and you can make almost a linear history from Plato to NATO, in which democracy starts in Athens and all the way to Australia, for example. Yeah? And that's, in fact, the conventional narrative. I say Australia, depending on where you are, it ends where you are. Yeah, sure. The United States ends in America, and Britain ends in Britain, etc. But the word democracy itself, as, you know, the work of, let's say, someone like John Keane has shown, demos is not a Greek word. It actually, what he's been able to trace it to, Sumerian, where it comes from damu, which means citizens of a it has different kinds of roots. You can tell different stories about it. If you mean democracy in a sense of freedom from arbitrary arrest and torture, if you mean democracy in a sense that people are able to conduct their lives more or less without fear, without undue tyranny, without all of those things that we understand it, with the ability to change their lives, then I don't think that this can be said there's only one way of doing it. And in fact, you could, and many of the Hezbollah and other groups would go on to say, well, Islam had what you call democracy. What they're concerned about is a notion of the sovereignty of the people versus sovereignty of God. And I think that's a mistake, because there's a confusion about what the sovereignty of the people means in relation to the sovereignty of God. I think it's quite compatible to believe that God is supreme and still believe in that people have the right to choose.
Mm. And in that, I mean, there's a tension there, I guess. It's an interesting tension. It's one that you often, it results in the caliphate often being described as a theocracy on one hand. On the other hand, there's an argument that, no, that the caliphate is not a theocracy, that that's precisely what it isn't. How do you unpack that one?
I think the idea that the caliphate is a theocracy is, again, a misnomer, and it comes from, again, taking the template of Western history as the only way of understanding the world. And it just runs into lots of these little problems. So take something like the issue of governance there. Now, for the most part, Muslim rulers up till the early modern period were often under severe checks by the law. And this is something you can look at, you know, many kind of historians have shown very detailed studies. Now, we, for example, often talk about the ideal constitution having a separation of powers. Well, one of the ways for historically the Muslims separated powers was not just by having an independent judiciary formally, but they had an independent judiciary because the judiciary and the legal system was not actually dependent on the state even for tax, for revenue. It got its pay and salary from other means. So it was completely independent in that sense. Now, again, if you look at the actual records of Sharia courts, where they are working autonomously, the kind of judgments they pass are very different than a lot of people's perception of what this system of governments would have meant. You often hear the metaphor saying, oh, these are, you know, the Muslims, this is a medieval institution. The thing is that the medieval, at the time of the medieval ages, the Muslims were in a very different position than what Europeans were. And many of the kind of punishments and practices that we associate with the medieval are much more associated with what was happening in Europe. Take something like witch trials. We estimate that maybe tens, if not hundreds of thousands of women were burnt at the stake for being witches in the Middle Ages. There is no evidence that such a mass phenomenon exists in the Muslim lands. Now, that's quite interesting, considering that you have this image that Islam is always misogynist. So why isn't it the case? Or take something like serfdom. There is very little evidence of extensive serfdom in the Muslim lands. So people were much more freer to go and move around. So again, when Muslims talk about the Sharia, when they talk about the caliphate or these things, for them, they see it through this kind of prism. They don't always see it through the kind of Western fantasy of what Islam was.
Medieval, I think, is an interesting word to bring into this, because it's a word that you hear associated with the caliphate. You know, people talk about groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir, and, well, they, you know, they're medievalists. They want to drag us all back to the 6th century and so on. And yet I wonder if you feel that at a time when the certain elements of Western hegemony are not looking as robust as they used to be, and the institution of the nation state is sort of breaking down in various interesting ways. And that being the case, do you think that there's something about the caliphate, the call for the caliphate, that's a sort of a postmodern gesture than a medieval one?
Well, that's partly the argument that I make in my book, that in a way the caliphate is an attempt to accept that the nation-state model is not fit for purpose in a world of globalization. And I think, so it's not an attempt to go back to the Middle Ages as such. I don't think that's really a viable or sustainable, you know, project. It's really an attempt to try and have a future in which you are the authors of your own future rather than reading someone else's script. And I think that's the really key. What the issue here is this. For reasons which, you know, for a number of very complex reasons, about a fifth to a quarter of the world's population calls themselves Muslims. And that calling themselves Muslim has become fairly important for them. It's important enough for them to feel that they get killed because of it. It's important enough for them to say, well, they want that to be recognized. But right now, there are no mechanisms which allow them to express this. So whenever they're confronted with situations, there is nothing that they feel they can really do about it without having to, resort to unconventional extra institutional means. And we know how power works, and power works best, as you said, when it's invisible, when it's institutionalized. Now, where we are right now in the world, it seems to me, the war on terror is a recognition of the weakening of Western hegemony. What the United States could do through persuasion, 50 years ago, it now needs to do by putting threats of drones or boots on the ground. And that, it seems to me, is a major weakening. It has to rely on coercion more and more. As you rely on coercion more and more, it undermines your legitimacy, which of course means that you should rely on coercion more and more. So you're in this vicious cycle. And I think the current political order in the Muslim lands is not robust enough to deal with these change of circumstances. So what you have, for example, ISIS really is a reflection of state failure, a failed state. And it's no different in that sense than what goes on in the borderlands between Mexico and the United States with the narco gangs, or what's happening in large parts of Africa or Central America, where you have these groups who actually emerge, these almost warlords, where the state writ is unable to run. And the main reason for ISIS's formation is really the failure of the post-invasion state building. The Iraqi state is not strong enough to deal with this. And the Syrian state, because of civil war, has been also weakened. So when this state collapses, warlordism is one outcome. And that's what I think ISIS should be understood as, rather than a caliph, more as a warlord.
Well, this all chimes with something that I'd like to briefly quote to you from Reza Pankhurst's book, The Inevitable Caliphate. I think it's important to note that there's a question mark at the end of that title. It's a book I know you'll be familiar with, and he talks about the way in which he says it may be that the end of Western history is in sight, where the dominant narratives and discourses that have stemmed from the West throughout the last couple of centuries are not only challenged but eventually overturned. And that as the people of the Middle East and beyond find their voice and are able to articulate their demands for good governance publicly, it would be foolish to try to sideline those who propose Islamic solutions. Is this sort of what you're getting at here?
I think Reza's onto something, and I think it's something that I've also written about and many others have. There's a sense in which the idea that Western narratives have the solution for everything is difficult to sustain. As a consequence, it is increasingly difficult to rule out other kinds of solutions simply by saying the West knows best. It's no longer the case the West knows best. Also, there is a shift in relations of power, the ability of Western governments, the ability to regulate the world has decreased dramatically. If you see what is happening now in Hong Kong, and I'm not in touch with Australian politics as much as I used to be, but I certainly know in the UK and the United States, there's no demand that either of these countries should be sending in military expeditions to ensure the well-being of the democratic movement in Hong Kong. I doubt it. There'd be many Australian politicians seriously contemplating that. And that, it seems to me, is kind of, and everyone knows why that is. We don't even need to spell it out. So I think the ability, for example, of Western models of what a company should be, how a firm should operate, to impose that on China has been completely absent. The Chinese have said, no, we're not going to do it that way. And then what? So I think this kind of, a lot of this is to be adjusting to the point that the world existed in which Europe, and I include, you know, Australia and America into that, was the center of that world. We are now moving towards the decentering of the West that is becoming less central. And that kind of period of adjustment is required for everyone. Decolonization isn't something that just happens over there. It's also something that needs to happen here in the metropolitan countries. And you see those things happening, perhaps not fast enough, but you see those struggles in nearly all these Western societies, Australia, United Kingdom, United States, Canada, all of them are struggling with this possibility of either adapting to a world which is going to be far more diverse, far more multicultural, or trying to roll back this tide of diversification and diversity, and like King Canute, just hold back the tide of history. Now, I think the choice for policymakers is whether they want to try and imitate King Canute or whether they want to learn to surf on the tides of history and try and accommodate a world which has many centers, many narratives, and find in that diversity strength, not fear.
Well, just finally, Salman, as we see that happening, as we see the decentering of the West, as you put it, do you think that there's a space opening up where we could seriously entertain the idea of the caliphate being restored? Is this something you can imagine happening within the foreseeable future, or is it all still pretty much a dream?
Look, I think dreams can come true. I think the issue about the caliphate is this. I certainly can imagine certain kinds of scenarios where you could have Muslim governments being able to cooperate in a manner with each other independently for sustained projects, for sustained outlooks. So I think that is possible. But I think we are at this right at the cusp of this. It is possible that you will have something emerging which will mean a greater representation for Muslim sentiment and Muslim voices, and the world will need to adjust to that. The other scenario is you know, this what we've been offered now, a generation or a multi-generational years of endemic violence. You know, you have to think that in the last 20 years, how many times have Australian, British, American troops and Air Force personnel been involved in some way or another in a war, armed conflict in Iraq? This is the third or fourth main intervention now. If this is the future of this constant, then I think it's really worrying for everyone. The neoconservative dream is that, you know what, by exercising Western power ruthlessly enough, we will be able to disaggregate these demands and we will be able to silence the Muslim expression. The Muslims will exist, but they'll only want things on Eid and halal, you know, those sort of things. It'll simply become a private matter. And, you know, again, there's no way of telling whether that's possible or not. My suggestion would only be this, that what you're talking about, the choices we face now is either greater democratization, which requires decolonization, or a perpetual dirty war, which will corrode not only societies which will be victim to drone attacks, assassinations, invasions, etc., but that kind of war will also delegitimize the democratic order in Western countries themselves. if you look at what has happened in the war on terror, if you ignore the violence that has been committed abroad, look at what's happened to issues of civil liberties. In the name of the terror threat, the American government has taken on itself the right to read everyone's email, more or less. It has taken on the right to check out whichever library book that you take out in any American library. And this is not just the American government. All Western governments have pushed back civil rights, which were part of their core identity, things that would be unimaginable. And the assault is not stopping now. Whenever governments introduce regulatory powers, they don't do so to prevent the people who are law-abiding. Their excuse is always that we want to stop the bad ones. The trouble is this, the actual laws, once they're there, affect everyone. And what you're seeing is the hollowing out of democracy in the effort to fight the war on terror. And the people who will suffer are not just the terrorists, not just their sympathizers, not just those who may have some stake in the caliphate. The people who suffer are all of us, because those civil rights, those liberal rights, those rights to be ourselves are being taken away without any sense of horror or shock or protest. And I think that's the real danger.